loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. We are joined for the full hour by Dr. Jill Stein. Dr. Stein is running for the Green Party nomination for the presidency in 2016. She was the 2012 Green Party candidate for president. She received 450,000 votes or more than any other woman candidate in U.S. history. On June 22, 2015, Jill Stein formally announced her candidacy for the Green Party's 2016 presidential nomination. She is a physician who graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1979 and practiced internal medicine. Jill Stein, welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you, Brian.
Thank you. You're running for the Green Party nomination in 2016. We see Bernie Sanders, a self-proclaimed Democratic socialist and longtime independent, running for president on the Democratic Party ticket and helping make socialism the most searched term on the internet. Are we seeing a shift in the political landscape in the United States?
Let's hope so. We badly need that. And I think it's clear that the American people are screaming for it. You can just look at recent polls. One done by the Wall Street Journal said that Democrats now account for 29% of American adults of voting age, and Republicans are 21, and the rest, 50%, have repudiated both of those parties. And it's no surprise that they have, because people are being thrown under the bus. Whether you are looking at wages, at jobs, the jobs that have come back, as the unemployment rate has come down, it's largely, you know, due to part-time, temporary, low-wage jobs and people dropping out of the workforce. At the same time, we're seeing cost of living skyrocket. 40 million young people and not so young are trapped in debt, college debt without a way to get out of it. We have massive expanding wars and a meltdown of the climate. You know, so we badly need transformational change. Whether that will happen inside of the Democratic Party or not, I think remains to be seen. The Democratic Party has had a kill switch for candidates of integrity for the past many decades, ever since George McGovern managed to get the nomination as a peace candidate.
Well, let me ask you about that, because Bernie Sanders has been known as an independent in the U.S. Senate. He's been known as a Democratic socialist, certainly given the fact that anti-communism became, in a way, the unofficial religion of the United States, I would say, after World War II and starting with the McCarthy era. He was a successful independent and self-proclaimed Democratic socialist candidate, but he's running inside the Democratic Party. What's the pressure on independent candidates to come within the Democratic Party? Is it something fundamental in terms of the way the Democratic, the electoral system in the United States is structured that forces even progressive people to, if they want to win, go inside one of the two dominant parties?
This is certainly the prevailing mythology that you have to work inside of the two big parties. And you know, you can look back to Eugene Debs as the socialist candidate in the early 1900s. He never got more than a few percent of the votes, but simply by running as an independent and running to the left of the two major parties, he was able to drive an agenda, and not only drive an agenda for a 40-hour week, for protection for workers, for retirement benefits. What we consider basic now to workers' rights was really driven by the Socialist Party in the early 1900s. And not only was it his campaign running outside the Democratic Party, but he helped lift up the fight for candidates running at lesser offices who were able to actually win office for mayor, for city councilors, for governors even, and senators and congressmen and women. And I think one can argue that when third parties folded and there was a coalition around the time of the New Deal that the independent parties largely came within the Democrats at the time of the New Deal. Forward progress ceased after that. So, you know, I think buying into the conventional wisdom that we have to silence ourselves outside of the mainstream parties has been very destructive to the cause of progressive values.
Well, we have a global listening audience in addition to the people inside the United States. And, of course, people in the United States are more acquainted with their own electoral system. But people in Europe, for instance, they may not fully understand how the U.S. political system works. In other words, Jill Stein and the Green Party in Europe, in any of the European countries with a parliamentary system, even if you got, say, 5 or 10% of the vote, you would have some representation in the parliament. But here we have a winner-take-all system. So if you want to win, in other words, yes, the socialists and third parties can make a difference by lifting and becoming a voice for broader social movements. But to actually win in the United States, isn't the system so set up that it makes it virtually impossible for third-party candidates to win? Isn't that why someone like Bernie Sanders, who was independent of the Democrats, then enters the Democratic Party on the presumption that that's the only way, given the structure of the two-party system, that they can possibly win?
Well, within the system, I'd say there's a fairly good argument that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Bernie is not the first candidate with integrity to run a really vibrant, inspired campaign within the Democratic Party. You know, you can look back to Dennis Kucinich, who was redistricted with the cooperation of the Democrats to basically silence him, was never allowed into the debates either. You can look at Howard Dean, who ran a very strong campaign and who was essentially torpedoed by the Democratic National Committee that ran a fear campaign and smear campaign against him, the so-called Dean Scream, which, you know, characterized him as a madman and knocked him down in the polls. Or you can look at Jesse Jackson, who had a vibrant campaign in the civil rights era and who was taken down again by the DNC with their smear campaign that characterized him as a guy who hated Israel. And they brought him down as an anti-Semite.
But at the end of the day, Jesse Jackson, who, you know, I was involved in the Jesse Jackson campaign in 1984 and 88, a remarkable campaign. I mean, mm-hmm. under a black civil rights leader, there was, of course, a very large African-American constituency, Latino constituency, and even very vibrant sectors of the working class who were not black and Latino from mm-hmm. Even the mines in Appalachia, where there are very, very few black people or people of color. A lot of people came together in that rainbow coalition. But at the end of the day, Jackson, in both 84 and 88, in spite of all of the support and in spite of the fact that many people would have followed him as an independent candidate, as a third party candidate, he too announced, OK, everyone, now let's support the Democratic Party candidate. Mondale in 84, Dukakis in 88. What's the pressure? I mean, how does it ever change if political leadership is unwilling to break from the two-party system?
Well, you know, I think you're making the key point right here. And the larger issue is that while the Democratic Party offers up these very inspired campaigns that at the end of the day it dismantles, it shafts, it pulls the rug out from under, at the same time the party keeps marching to the right. This is the whole reason, you know, in my view, why it's really important for us to struggle against the system. I think we are at an absolutely unique moment in history. Just to look at the climate crisis alone, you know, we're not going very much farther down this road. We got a couple decades and that's it. I think this is a moment of great awakening. And you can look at the numbers politically. Most people have dropped out now. They have repudiated both of the major parties. So we are seeing the makings of a real shift. And remember, this has happened once before at the time of the Civil War, where you had great social upheaval. You had the emergence of a third party in the form of the Republican Party, which adopted the agenda.
And the Democratic Party split into two, in fact, in 1860, which helped, you know, become the precursor to the American Civil War, which
yes.
then led to profound change, but it took a civil war, in fact.
It did indeed, and let's hope it doesn't take that again. But, you know, clearly we are up against the wall here. We are up against, you know, an absolutely unprecedented historic development where whatever you call it capitalism, call it corporatism, you know, it's the establishment, the oligarchy, the economic elite, which is represented by the two political mainstream parties. It is throwing us over the cliff right now, and you're seeing a big wake up to that. Look at, you know, the younger generation alone, 40 million young people and not so young people who are trapped in debt, for whom there is no relief. Bernie Sanders' campaign does not offer, you know, debt cancellation. It's just sort of a rescheduling of debt. Our campaign is the only one that will cancel debt. Now, if that word gets out, you could see a real political revolution at the polls, and it's not going to happen, excuse me, inside of the Democratic Party.
One of the issues you've passionately advocated for over the years has been campaign finance reform. The Sanders campaign has certainly put this in a spotlight with his calls for a political revolution against the 1%. His campaign is the first in U.S. history to receive 2 million public donors, most of them small donors.
Mm-hmm.
But in the New York Times in October issued a study that demonstrated that 158 families or individuals had given as much in campaign donations for this round of the presidential election cycle as 50% of the country. In other words,
yeah.
half of the donations put in came from 158 families and individuals. That was 176 million. Now you have in 2012, the total amount spent on the elections, on the U.S. election cycle, that included the president, the House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate, that number was $6.285 billion for the election. Of those, $3.644 billion came to congressional races, and the presidential campaign, the campaign between Obama and the Republicans, was $2.621 billion. I mean, of course, Mitt Romney is a multi-millionaire, but these candidates cannot raise billions of dollars without relying on the corporate oligarchy, as you put it. I mean, isn't that a fundamental problem in the U.S. electoral system?
Of course, yes. I mean, absolutely it is. And to my mind, that is why, you know, that's why it's very unlikely that Bernie is going to be able to prevail where Jesse Jackson couldn't or where Dennis Kucinich couldn't, because the system is set up you know, to be basically run by predatory banks, by fossil fuel corporations, and by war profiteers, insurance executives, et cetera, the usual suspects. This is who is flourishing under the current economic and political environment. And I think, you know, we're not going to, this is not an easy struggle. It really requires transformational change. It requires the building of a movement. You know, this is a house of cards that is going to fall down. It's already, you know, been rotted from within. The only question is when it is going to fall. In my view, like Woody Allen says, half of life is showing up. It's very important for the principled alternative to be there, to be on the record about what is wrong and about specifically how we can fix it, and that there is a fix. There is a win-win here that people need to know about. And, you know, at some point, history is going to, you know, is going to call the shots here. And this house of cards is going to come down. And if we have done our homework and if we have organized and if we are using all the means that are available to us, and that's not the corporate press, you know, and it's not expensive TV advertising, but there are other means of really driving change, and we have seen, you know, profound changes that we never expected. For example, stopping the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, recently, that were going to rule against an open internet. And, you know, that and many other decisions have happened when we the people have organized under the radar, using in part the internet and using responsible journalists like yourself that aren't afraid to raise the real questions and vet real solutions. You know, we're going to see real change happen.
Let me ask you, as you mentioned, there are, of course, always positive signs, and there's many, many struggles calling for reforms, far-reaching reforms, mm-hmm. and those movements and those struggles, they resonate, they're heard, and they lead over time and after arduous conflict to some significant reforms. But then there are other reforms that are going in the exact opposite direction, like take Citizens United. Mm-hmm. You have a right-wing Supreme Court. Citizens United declares that giving money to presidential and congressional and other political races is a form of free speech, and thus it must be unregulated. In other words, corporate entities or private billionaires can give in an unfettered way as much money as they want to whoever they want. Now, I want to ask you, you talked about a house of cards that will eventually fall down. It seems to me, in some way, the Citizens United, which was done on behalf of corporations and perhaps the politically conservative parts of the electorate, it seems that it may have backfired. When you look at the Republican Party primaries, each of these candidates, who actually don't stand a chance, many of them, can continue to run and run and run in the primaries because they don't run out of money because they're the horse that some billionaire bet on.
Exactly.
I mean, is it backfiring?
It seems that way. I mean, you hear now that the Republican Party is in a panic. They're looking at having a brokered convention and trying to bring Mitt Romney in, you know, at the 11th hour in, 59 minutes.
That sounds like the 25th hour to me. Mitt Romney. Wow.
Yes,
I
know.
Salvation.
Isn't that incredible? But, you know, the Republican Party is kind of, you know, the inner circle, at any rate, is in a real panic. But, you know, I mean, these are the kinds of crazy things that happen when a society becomes so out of balance that 20 billionaires, super billionaires, you know, now have the equivalent, or to put it another way, 20 U.S. billionaires have as much wealth as half of the American population. You know, it's absolutely staggering. And when money is so horrifically, obscenely concentrated, all kinds of weird, crazy things start happening. And to my mind, that's just part of how this system is going to fall. And yes, there are crazy things like Citizens
United.
Jill
Stein, we're gonna have to break away very briefly. We will be right back. And I want to go to the question of global warming. You were in Paris at the climate summit. I want to talk about that, but we'll be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back with Jill Stein running for president again in 2016 on the Green Party nomination. We want to talk about the environment. You are the Green Party all around the world. The Green Party is struggling, demanding real substantial change for the problem of global warming, which obviously could be the paramount, the number one, the dominant issue, threatening the very survival of the planet and all of the species that inhabit it. You were recently in Paris for the COP21 Climate Summit, the 21st yearly session of the Conference of the Parties to the 1992 United Nations Framework on the Convention on Climate Change. World leaders were there. What did you make of the convention? What happened? Was it significant?
You know, what happened was that world leaders endorsed an agreement which is essentially not an agreement. It's an agreement essentially of hot air, of verbiage, and no pun intended on that. But it's an agreement that basically does nothing and sort of sits back on its laurels. It's an agreement that was essentially the result of U.S. leading the charge to dismantle the work of the prior 20 years. And the one achievement that is touted is that the goal for limiting temperature rise to 1.5 degrees centigrade instead of 2 degrees centigrade. That's the much, you know, celebrated goal. And yes, that's great. This is more realistic as a goal. Though truth to tell, we can't afford any more warming from where we are right now, which is about 1 degree. But, you know, at the same time, they basically said, so it's every nation for themselves, decide what you want to do, and nobody's going to hold you accountable. So it essentially scuttled the work of the past couple of decades that had an agreement for reparations, of providing support from the wealthy polluting nations who've caused this to assist those who are in trouble. And in fact, when you add up what this agreement amounts to, it overshoots even the former higher ceiling for what was allowable, and it creates somewhere around 3 or up to 3.5 degrees of warming. So it really throws in the towel. And I think it's another way in which, you know, you mentioned the system is backfiring against itself. It is. It is self-destructing. And as climate continues to unravel, I think there's a growing mobilization. And polls show now, even in the U.S., it's about 70% of people that are clamoring for true substantive action.
Let me ask you. I'm looking at an article that was the Guardian newspaper in the UK. The headline is James Hansen, father of climate change awareness, calls Paris talks, quote, a fraud.
That's right.
And he says it's a fraud, really a fake. It's just BS. That stands for bad sociology. For them to say we'll have a 2°C centigrade warming target and then just try to do a little bit better every 5 years, it's just worthless words. There is no action, just promises. As long as fossil fuels appear to be the cheapest fuels out there, they will continue to be burned. Do you agree with him?
I agree with him that the plan is really a fraud, that it is BS. It has nothing to do with science. In the words of Obama, you know, you knew the minute Obama gave his speech that it was basically all over, and this was right at the beginning, where he said that, you know, it was going to be the entrepreneurs who save us, that it's Bill Gates and, you know, and Mr. Facebook who are basically going to solve this problem. You know, it was clear at that point that this had nothing to do with reality and that this is more about you know, profiteering.
Let's say the American political system was reformed enough that the message that you have or other independent candidates have, which obviously resonate when people get to hear you, they don't get to hear you much because you're not on the corporate-owned TV channels. But let's say you were the president of the United States. What specific actions would you take immediately, like immediately, on the issue of climate change?
So let me say, this is not rocket science. This is not an impossible problem to solve. This simply requires that we have leadership that is truly leadership, not misleadership, that's actually acting on behalf of the American people and the people of the world, for that matter. So here's what we do. Number one, we declare an emergency. This is a state of emergency. Much like an emergency was declared after Pearl Harbor was bombed, this is an emergency far greater than that. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, we converted our economy. It took us 6 months to move from 0% of GDP to 25% of GDP on a wartime footing. So we need to create a comparable national project at this point, a wartime level mobilization that will completely move to 100% clean renewable energy, wind, water, and sun, in the next 15 years. So by 2030, we have zeroed out fossil fuels. And the minute we do this, this is actually a wonderful thing because it not only solves the climate problem, it also solves the problem of our economy. It puts everyone back to work who needs a job in a full-time job for living wages. And in addition, this makes wars for oil obsolete. So this is a plan that actually pays for itself because we get to cut back so profoundly on the incredible, wasted, catastrophic over-militarization of our foreign policy. But it also turns out there's an incredible health benefit, because what's good for the planet and the economy also turns out to be really good for human health.
Right now, under our current economic system, corporations, say ExxonMobil, the largest producer and seller of petroleum products, they have the legal right, because they own the oil, they own the refining facilities, they own the transport, they have an infrastructure, they have the right to produce petroleum products, and their investors invest in them because they expect a profit return. And in fact, they're investing with them because they expect a maximum profit return, not just some profits, but maximum profits. That's why capital flows into ExxonMobil or any other corporation, but I'm using them by way of example.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get to completely renewable energy sources when you have an economic order that allows ExxonMobil to be the deciders over whether they should continue to produce and sell petroleum products and other products? How does that square? In other words, can you have this kind of major radical overhaul within 15 years that really does something significant about global climate change and allow the economic apparatus that exists right now to remain intact? And if not, what would you do with them? What would you do with ExxonMobil?
Great. I mean, you're exactly right. And Jim Hansen's solution, which is to put a price on carbon, is not enough. It's important and it should be done, but that alone isn't going to do it, which is why it's really critical, and this is a piece of our program, our so-called Green New Deal. It also calls for basically democratizing energy and claiming our energy resources as a national resource, and we need to nationalize our fossil fuel companies.
Okay, so the Green Party is for nationalizing ExxonMobil. What other major industries? I'm not talking about just generally needed or helpful, but from the point of view of affecting the transition, the transformation immediately, short term, on an emergency basis, as you proclaimed it, to a renewable energy platform. What other industries need to be nationalized?
I think we basically identified three areas of the economy that need to be greened. And if nationalization is required, then that bridge has to be crossed. But currently, you know, we've identified energy, food, and transportation. And, you know, at the same time, we have called for an economic bill of rights. We're not the first ones to call for it, but it calls for affordable transportation as a basic human right, along with healthcare and education as well. As well as a right to affordable housing. So, you know, whether these other industries require nationalization, I'm not sure about that. I don't know that any of them have a monopoly in the same way that the oil companies have a monopoly on oil resources. But I think, you know, we need to make profound progress, and we have called for basically subsidizing a massive jobs creation program in the areas of energy, as well as totally reforming and restructuring our food system so that we have a local and sustainable agricultural system instead of agribusiness and this industrial GMO-based agri-system, which is extremely destructive. In ensuring that the investments also go into transportation to ensure that we have a public transit development as well as safe sidewalks and bike paths so that everyone, you know, has a right to affordable, efficient, and convenient, high-quality public transportation.
Let me ask you as you mentioned, James Hansen is for his program, and why he calls the Paris conference a fraud is that the conference would have to adopt rules that would put a very heavy levy or tax or fee on carbon emitters. In other words, he says $15 a ton that would rise $10 a year and bring in $600 billion in the U.S. alone, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You said that's not enough. So you're for nationalizing ExxonMobil and the other giant energy monopolies, the oil monopolies as they're known. Of course, we have coal, we have nuclear power, but you have an entire economy that's based on energy sources that are largely not renewable. Will it require the kind of, given what happens in Congress, I mean, you and I both know that what's happening in Congress in terms of legislative actions, it's so curtailed, it's so slowed down. Whenever something even mildly liberal comes down the pike, you have eons of liberal of conservative lobbies and business lobbies and corporate lobbies and banking lobbies that are there to gum up the works. How do you get to a point where there's this kind of economic transformation? Does it happen through the legislative process? Is that realistic? If it's a radical street-based, you know, grassroots movement, how does it affect the transformation? Because it comes down, it seems to me, to a question of who holds the power, who holds the economic power, who gets to make the decisions.
Of course. And right now, these decisions, as you know, are purely made based on, you know, on money and influence and backroom deals and influence peddling. You know, that's what the American political system is. But remember, 50% of people are locked out. In the last election in 2014, you know, it was, it was a little bit over a third of voters who actually voted. So that's two-thirds who are voting with their feet, saying that this system is not worth voting for. And by the way, that is why, in my view, the lesser evil paves the way to the greater evil. We see that over and over again, that when people are, you know, with the Democratic Party having adopted an agenda that is just barely one shade, bluer than red, just, you know, one step not as bad, people don't bother coming out for it anymore. And so the lesser evil will lose anyhow, because it's the, you know, it's the oligarchs and the wealthy that will come out to vote.
I thank you for that. I mean, it reminds me of something in our even recent history that speaks to it and also suggests how change comes about. When in the 1964 presidential election campaign, seems like a long time ago, half a century, but it was a big election. LBJ was running as the lesser evil against Barry Goldwater, who seemed like a maniac, who really wanted to take the country to war with the Soviet Union, even though that seemed like madness and in fact was madness. Goldwater, you know, was soundly defeated. People breathed a sigh of relief because Johnson, the lesser evil, became president. Mm-hmm. And unlike Goldwater, who promised to increase the war, escalate the war in Vietnam, that Johnson was now the president. And he immediately escalated the war in Vietnam, and it became the Democratic Party's war. Mm-hmm. And many, many, many Democrats didn't come into the streets at first. And that's why a new movement basically of young people who were not really part of the Democratic Party establishment started the anti-war movement in Vietnam. And that led to so many profound changes in America. I mean, will it be young people now who have to take the leadership because the lesser evil sort of political mindset just has taken in such big parts of the electorate?
I think it's for whatever reason. Historically, it seems always to be young people who are at the forefront of transformational change. And, you know, this is exactly why my campaign, you know, is really lifting up the issue of student debt, because not only does it create, you know, an economic sand trap from which a generation can never escape, but it also essentially removes from political action, it removes from community life an entire generation who's really responsible for reimagining the future and for moving us forward and shedding the excess baggage, you know, the dead weight, the old skin of yesterday's vision. So it really does fall to young people to stand up and fight. And that's why, you know, a key part of our campaign is getting out the word to young people that if they want 40 million votes coming out to cancel debt in November of 2016, will not only accomplish that, 40 million is essentially a plurality of a three-way vote. So young people actually have the capacity to take this election by storm if they decide to do that. And in doing so, they can also, you know, move forward an agenda, which is basically an agenda of justice, because young people are on the receiving end of an incredibly corrupt and predatory system. And they're getting it not only on debt and the high cost of education, but also the absence of jobs, the economy, and lastly, on the climate.
Yeah, I mean, when one hears you, they're obviously hearing a very informed person, very articulate, someone who could speak to the issues. It would seem to me that your message and the message of other independent political candidates, I know there are a few others, there's Gloria LaRiva, there's, of course, Bernie Sanders, who is now running inside the Democratic Party and who the Democratic Party establishment seems to be targeting. There are people who make a lot of sense and would be, it would seem to me, very convincing to that, you know, 40 million people who need to vote for them, or 30 million or 20 million or however many you just mentioned. But people don't actually hear you on CNN or on NBC or in the even in the presidential debates. I mean, why is it that the corporate media is so unwilling to have the Green Party in the United States or the other independent parties be presented on mainstream TV? And if that were to happen, what do you think the reaction would be? Do you think that the Green Party could become like a major or even a majority party with enough coverage?
I have no doubt, because, you know, we actually had a little test case of this back in 2002 in the first election that I ever ran in, where I was running against Mitt Romney for the governorship of Massachusetts. And we fought our way into a debate, because even back in 2002, people were tearing their hair out at the incredibly inane, mind-numbing nature of our debates between Democrats and Republicans. So there was an open debate, which included myself and a couple other independent candidates, as well as the Democrat.
Jill Stein, we're gonna pick up on that thought when we come right back after a short break.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back with Jill Stein. We're talking about why is it that the Green Party and other independent parties who have a message that resonates with a big part of the population just can't get media attention or corporate-owned media attention inside the United States. Jill Stein, you were talking about your own experience in the 2002 election. Can you start over again?
Yes. You know, my experience shows why they are locking us out, because they're running scared. In the one televised debate that I was actually allowed into, in the first race that I ever ran, running for governor in Massachusetts against Mitt Romney, we fought our way into the debate, and I put forward, you know, our agenda, which was clear then, for green energy, for downsizing the military and putting those resources into true security here at home, for health care and education as human rights, et cetera. Those ideas went down like lead balloons inside the TV studio, which was just candidates and moderator. But when we walked out, I was mobbed by the press, who told me that I had won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. So immediately I was yanked out of the debates, not allowed in anymore, because my ideas were way too dangerous and resonating with the public, and they never did another instant online viewer poll in a televised debate. So to me, that was a real window in on what the political strategy is out there of the mainstream. They are absolutely running scared, and they've created this scam that's intended to characterize us, the Green Party, as the fringe, when in fact we are truly a voice that is of, by, and for the people. So to my mind, it's just a question of when the right strategies are going to line up. And remember, young people are self-organized. So this is a communications network that can essentially grab the ball and run with it. So I'm not holding my breath, but I'm not ruling it out either. At some point, the House of Cards is coming down, and the people are rising up with a new vision for how we can move forward.
We see not only in the United States, where the Sanders campaign, yes, inside the Democratic Party, but as a self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist, and your campaign and other independent socialist candidates, they're obviously getting much more traction than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But we see it not just in the United States, but all over Europe. There is also a rising tide of anti-austerity politics.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a rise in Greece with the election of Syriza, which originally was on a very staunch anti-austerity program, even though the Syriza leadership later compromised or capitulated based on your view of it. You have Podemos in Spain. You have the election to the leadership of the Labour Party in the UK of Jeremy Corbyn. That's amazing. Jeremy Corbyn was an anti-war activist, a real radical, somebody who was based in the trade unions, considered completely unlikely to win the leadership position of the Labour Party, and yet he did so. And that, too, was from an outpouring of new recruits to the Labour Party, young people who came in record numbers to huge, huge campaign meetings, just as they are for Bernie Sanders. You were in the UK. You met with Jeremy Corbyn. You created with him something called the Transatlantic Peace Offensive. What is that?
Okay, so just to clarify, we met in Paris. I actually didn't make it to the UK, not yet. But we did meet in Paris, and we had a wonderful discussion. And I presented to him an initiative we've been developing, and we call it a peace offensive because people are used to thinking of peace as something passive. It's not. It requires a very active an aggressive campaign. The difference is it's not dropping bombs and it doesn't rely on bullets because they have proven themselves not only ineffective but actually catastrophic. And we've created failed states and a massive refugee crisis. And we've been the best friend imaginable to organized global terrorism. So, you know, bombs and bullets are not the way to go. The alternative is not just sitting back and doing nothing. It's actually stopping terrorism at its roots. And it's important to go back to what it is that's driving this madness to start with. You can go all the way back to the CIA and the Saudis, you know, creating jihadism with the Mujahideen in order to basically undermine a left-leaning government in Afghanistan. But, you know, more recently than that, the Saudis have been pouring money and resources into the creation of jihadi movements all over the world. And not only that, but they are arming them. We ourselves are arming terrorists who, you know, are constantly shuffling. They don't particularly have allegiances. Or I should say, rather than calling them terrorists, let me just call them armed insurrection, because it's very hard to say where local uprisings against dictatorships and occupation, where it crosses the line with indigenous terrorist movements, you know, and then there's state terrorism. And the point is the U.S. has been pouring gasoline on this fire for a long time.
Well, you have the United States invaded Iraq in March 2003, and destroyed the sovereign government of Iraq and dismantled its army. And then Iraq obviously fragmented, and that created the space for the rise of what we have now, ISIL. The United States carried out, along with Britain, France, the NATO bombing of Libya in the name of protecting civilians, according to a UN resolution that authorized them to do that. But it was obvious that that was about regime change. And finally, they did create regime change, and the leader, Gaddafi, was killed. And Libya has now fragmented, and the United States and Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned, its principal ally along with Turkey, were funneling arms and money into different armed opposition groups against a sovereign government in Syria. And in the case of Saudi Arabia and Turkey, much of that money and support was going to groups like Al-Qaeda and the Army of Conquest and ISIL, the so-called Islamic State.
Right, al-Nusra Front, and you know, fighters are continually shuffling between one group and another, and we were arming and training one group of militants. You know, we've tried to separate out the moderate militants from the extremist militants, or shall we say the moderate terrorists against the extremist terrorists. You know, this is all just nonsense, and we need to stop pouring arms into the Middle East. The U.S. supplies the vast majority of arms. We've just completed $100 billion worth of sales to the Saudis, who are, you know, supplying them to all kinds of people. Turkey, likewise, and Qatar have all been a part of this incredible ocean of arms that's been flowing in to arm all parties on all sides. So the U.S. has the capacity to shut down arms shipments. It is not only an arms embargo to Syria and potentially all of the Middle East, it is also a freeze on the funds of countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey that continue to arm and finance terrorist organizations. Instead of just telling the Saudis they need to clean up their act, which we began to do after 9/11, which has been completely ineffective and to which there's been no response, we need to actually start putting some muscle behind this and freezing their bank accounts or seizing the bank accounts of the countries that continue to do this. We need to stop Turkey from buying the oil that basically generates profit for ISIS, and we need to ensure that Turkey is actually shutting down its border to the influx of jihadi militants. Turkey is a member of NATO, and its NATO status needs to be put on the line if it continues, to basically fan the flames of terrorism here. So there are things we can do. This is what we were putting on the table, not only for Jeremy Corbyn, but for all sorts of activists who were in Paris, and then we were later in Moscow for a conference that was held by RT. So there were a lot of advocates and academics and journalists there, and it was a really exciting and very interesting discussion. A lot of, I should say, members of governments, foreign members of governments as well, who really agreed that this policy of the U.S. Is absolutely insane.
And do you see any
right now to shut it down?
Do you see any shift happening? There's the Vienna 2 summit, which included this time over. Previously, the United States had objected to Iran's participation, but Iran was there along with the United States and Russia and other powers, the sort of a large number, I think maybe 15 powers. They came together. They said, let's have the beginning of ceasefires, local ceasefires, possibly a national ceasefire, with some parts of the opposition to the Assad government, of course, excluding ISIL and al-Qaeda and the Army of Conquest and al-Nusra, that there would be a negotiation between those parties, and then ultimately, within 18 months, a national election. In other words, where the Syrian people could vote for what would be presumably a government of national unity. Do you think that's possible? And also, you must notice, as it's hard not to notice, that there's been a stark shift in the rhetoric and even in the position of the Obama administration in relationship to the Syrian government, where in the past the United States demanded as a mantra, Assad must go. That language has shifted, and now obviously the Syrian government is considered to be part of the political process leading to a possible resolution of this terrible civil war. Has there been a major shift in the Obama administration?
There certainly seems to be an opening here that there hasn't been for a long time. And this is wonderful for the U.S. to consider being a collaborator rather than a dominator, which has been kind of the major U.S. approach to foreign policy. But I will say that this is a fledgling effort. It's a critical and very important effort. It will be far more successful if the U.S. actually insists that its allies, the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Turks, stop funding and arming the jihadi opposition, you know, whether it's al-Nusra or ISIS or, you know, al-Qaeda in its other forms. This is really critical. So I think these two processes need to complement each other. We do need this this process of negotiations and of a ceasefire, but we also need to ensure that the U.S. stops pouring gasoline on the fire. And we need to shut down on our weapons industry, which is looking to make a buck and looking to make sales here. We have to ensure that we stop the weapons sales. We need to do it unilaterally and then get others to join us, too.
Let me ask you, in terms of Green Party foreign policy, or, again, if you were elected president, if you had enough media attention, if you were able to have full access, if you won the presidency, if you were the president starting January 20th, 2017, what would your position be regarding U.S. policy with Israel? Because you've mentioned Saudi Arabia, you've mentioned Qatar, Turkey, but here you have Israel, which is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, not just in the region, but globally. And, of course, there's the obvious violations of U.N. resolutions and the continued occupation of the West Bank, the almost endless siege and war, de facto war against Gaza, as well as all of the discriminatory policies against Israel's Arab population. And yet, even though Netanyahu has defied Obama, has treated the American government with contempt, has continued to build settlements, has continued to carry out provocations, the U.S. continues to fund Israel to the tune of $3.5 billion a year. Would the Green Party end U.S. aid to Israel if you were the president?
So it's $8 million a day that the U.S. provides to a government which is in flagrant violation, as you point out, of international law and, needless to say, human rights. And I think, you know, we need a uniform policy that applies across the board to the foreign policies of the United States of America. And that is that we abide by international law, we abide by human rights, and we exercise diplomacy wherever possible, and not, you know, not utilize this program of total military and economic domination. So, yes, in accord with that basic approach to foreign policy, we would say to Israel that you do not get aid and assistance while you continue to flagrantly violate international law. And I think we need to be supporting the grassroots groups on the Israeli and on the Palestinian side that have done a great job of building trust at the grassroots level, of collaborating on behalf of human rights, and, you know, let them take the lead as the indigenous parties to help build confidence and build trust so that we can move forward with a real peace process.
The Israeli government is engaged not only in building settlements, but there is, from the settlers, a reign of terror going on against the Palestinian people. There is, at the same time, I would say, apartheid clearly as a system of social and political control inside of Israel proper. During the 1980s, when confronted with the urgent need to change the and get rid of the apartheid government in South Africa, there was the international movement to boycott South Africa. And that made a significant difference, not only politically, but financially. And in fact, it caused many of the international backers of the apartheid, racist apartheid government, principally the Washington government, from shifting its position. Now we have BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanction, and it's happening on college campuses, it's happening in churches, it's happening in mosques, it's happening in some within some sectors of the Jewish community, American Jewish community against Israel. Does the Green Party support the BDS movement?
For 10 years now, the Green Party has been on record supporting BDS, as is our campaign as well. And I heard today that the European Union, in fact, is also now requiring that any products produced in occupied territories be labeled as produced in the occupied territories, sort of a partial capitulation to the BDS movement.
That's right. We have just 2 minutes left. The hour goes fast, but you're a doctor. You're a medical doctor. We had under President Obama, when he came into office, the pledge that there would be universal health care in the United States. He immediately said single-payer health plan is off the table, even though a New York Times poll showed that more than 70% of the American people would favor single-payer health care like Medicare for All. He said it was off the table, and he introduced what was Mitt Romney's program, more or less, the one from Massachusetts, which was essentially privatizing all of health care. So now some people have access to what's called Obamacare, people who did not have health care, and yet the rates are sky high, the premiums are high, the number of people who are being kicked off of health care coverage because some of the exchanges are going out of business because they were more or less a public option. I mean, we have a healthcare crisis, a healthcare system in crisis for tens of millions of Americans. Again, Jill Stein, if you were president of the United States, what would you do and what would your first acts be in as the president regarding healthcare?
We would move to a Medicare for All system, and there is public support for it, especially now that Obamacare, which we called Romneycare here in my home state of Massachusetts, it has been such a, you know, a flagrant failure, as was known really from the start by, you know, close observers or informed observers. It's taking exactly the course that was predicted. People have their piece of paper, but it doesn't cover them. Unfortunately, when they get sick, medical bankruptcies have not been alleviated in the least under the system. It's time for single payer.
So single payer now. Jill Stein, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.